Colonel Hazen, who's got the volunteers that he's made drill and drill and be disciplined, you know, he didn't come in with an assumption of, do I have good data? Do I not have good data? He came in with an ethos. You know, he came in with the belief that we are not going to embarrass ourselves. That's what's important today, is that we're going to own the moment that we're in and do the best with what we have, whatever that is. And so he's told to hold this point. He's given some reinforcements. Boys, we're going to hold this point.
Welcome again to It Doesn't Take a Genius, conversation with introspective perspectives and pithy points of view. Here are your hosts, my friends, Max and Marty.
I think that's Mark and Mike.
Yeah, whatever.
Ramsey!
Marshall, I am so excited to be here with you today and combine many, many threads that we've been discussing over the course of time. This is going to be a fun one.
Oh,
my opinion, but I think it's going to be fun.
I'm excited because I have no idea what's happening. And I kind of like it that way.
And you kind of like it that way. I know you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, for our folks at home, there's a picture. Our people listening on the podcast, there's a picture on the screen.
We would recommend that you know, this one's a great one to listen to, but the YouTube video is going to have quite a few photos that we'll be sharing along the way. So, we have some field research that we're going to present today.
And so our subscriber price is going to remain the same despite this bonus footage and pictures.
For our mega fans. sorry, I was going to make a joke there, but that is the joke, isn't it? It's just sort of just by itself.
Yeah. We love our mega fans.
We do. We absolutely do. I want to talk about the Battle of Stones River, also known as the Second Battle of Murfreesboro, which happened in Tennessee, sort of southeast, I guess, of Nashville. And my family toured the battlefield, the national battlefield, last summer. There's a picture right now, I believe. Can you see it?
I can. And so for clarity's sake, just to define, this battle took place in the I believe it was the War of Northern Aggression, as you guys call it.
I'm glad you finally admitted that I'm not a Midwesterner. That's what's important to me. It's a stunning, stunning battle. It has the highest percentage of casualties on both sides. I mean, this is a really, really, really bloody battle. And I can kind of set it up, but I'll just sort of give folks a preview that we've been talking in our last episode about the Emancipation Proclamation, about what it means to be free and suddenly have choices that you're responsible for and that you own. And so as I sort of hit some highlights here of the things that caught my family's attention, I would just encourage you at home to be thinking about, you know, what did all this hinge on? There are so many parts of this battle that hinge on a decision or a person or an action. And so I'm just going to sort of paint a little bit of that picture and use some photos to go along with that, if that's okay with you, Mike.
Oh, I am excited for the additional media, stimuli.
I know I think deep in your heart, you want to be a YouTube influencer. I think that's really actually a goal of yours. And, you know, it turns out business people don't have the same rabid fascination with YouTube following the way, like, say, Mr. Beast's, you know, preteen audience does. But you know, hey, we're going to make a go of it. So
wait, you're saying we're not YouTube influencers? What? Well, this is news. Can't spring that on somebody in the middle of a podcast.
My kids watch a lot of Dude Perfect, as we have discussed previously on the podcast. I don't think we're at their level yet. I mean, we haven't agreed to build a multi-million-dollar theme park. You know, we haven't given away $1 million on air or anything like that. But hey, let's just see what happens. Right. So maybe this is the start of it all right here. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about the background here. We have General Bragg, who is the Confederate general for this one, Braxton Bragg. He has just left Kentucky after the Battle of Perryville, home of Elmwood NTs. And if you are a client or a partner of mine, you know all about Elmwood NTs because I give those as Christmas gifts every year. Just the best tea in the world. But after the Battle of Perryville, he leaves Kentucky through the Cumberland Gap. He's known as a disciplinarian. In fact, shortly before the Battle of Stones River, he executes a Kentucky soldier who had deserted. It's a little more complicated than that. It was his second desertion, to be fair, but the guy deserted because his father had died suddenly. His mom was back home with a bunch of young kids. He had requested leave. He had actually finished up his tour and was ready to unenlist, and Bragg had refused. And so he went AWOL to go home and plant a garden for his mom. Bounty hunter finds him, brings him back. He is part of the Orphan Brigade, as it's known, Kentucky's volunteer regiment that came out of, it's Kentucky's only, I think, volunteer regiment that worked for, fought for the South. He has the dude's own Orphan Brigade execute him, and it takes three volleys to make it happen. Brigadier General John Breckinridge was the famous and very popular Kentucky general over the Orphan Brigade, and he apparently on his horse became physically sick when this execution happened. So that happens shortly before all of this. Bragg's known as a disciplinarian. Breckinridge hates him now. Things are not going well. Dissension in the ranks. Other side, in the north, we have General Buell has been relieved of command shortly after the Battle of Perryville because he didn't pursue. Lincoln's getting sick of it, and so he puts this General Rosecrans in charge. William Rosecrans, he was this hard-drinking Catholic. He would keep them up till 4 a.m., regaling them with stories and debating religion with his leadership team. He would become a real fast talker during combat, and was sort of a thorn in the side of people above him, but his troops loved him. He really went out of his way to take care of his troops. So those are the two sides. We've got 40,000 some Union soldiers, 30,000 some Confederate soldiers. Some of the Union soldiers had never been tested in battle. The Confederates had at least three different brigades that were cavalry harassing. Before the battle even started, they had caught 1,000 Union troops and destroyed or stolen three wagon trains. That's before the battle even starts. Long story short, December 30th, 1862, they're about 700 yards apart in lines formed near Murfreesboro, and they have a battle of the bands. Yankee Doodle Dandy is played, and the Confederates play Dixie, and it goes back and forth like that for a while. Finally, the North plays Home Sweet Home, and the South joins in, and then all the soldiers start singing. So we have this Francis Tolliver moment, if you're familiar with the World War One story about how they came across on Christmas Eve. That's what happens the day before New Year's Eve, when this battle is going to kick off. So they all basically go to bed knowing that the next morning they're going to attack. It turns out that both groups sort of had a plan to attack the right flank and cut off the base of the opposing army. And sort of, like if you could, hindsight being 20/20, it seems like whoever strikes first wins. It's, it's going to be that point blank. Well, so that night before New Year's Eve and the battle kicks off, that night of December 30th, Rosecrans is visiting his troops saying, "Hey, do me a favor, please put out your fires." At one point, he's telling them to do this on a very cold and rainy night, and bullets start whizzing by. He was right. He's proven right as he's going up to each of his troops and telling them, "Put out your fires, put out your fires." So long story short, December 31st at dawn, Bragg's troops strike first. The South strikes first. Union soldiers die with coffee cups in their hand around their morning fires. It's an almost complete rout. It would have been a complete rout. The army would have been destroyed, except there was one major general, Philip Sheridan. Yes, the Sheridan tank is named after this guy. That's how important he is to us. He just had a premonition, started thinking, and he had his troops up and ready and in line by 4 a.m. The whole battle hinges around his position. Basically, his troops and some folks that he had to fall back and help, another major general, they're the only two groups that are able to hold the line that morning. Everything else folds up around them. And it is incredibly bloody. I need to start showing you some pictures now. So this is where they went to. It's an area that has a bunch of limestone trenches. And they literally are trenches, like a man could fit down in there. They've worn down over time, but you can see they've got some silhouettes on the battlefield to show you, you know, the size of a soldier compared to these things. Tons and tons of trenches. This is where they retreated to, and it was an area that became known as the slaughter pen. Sheridan loses like all three of his brigade commanders. A brigade, I think, is around 800 men. A third of his men are casualties by that late morning. And overall, in the entire battlefield, the Confederates are just running over the Union. 28 guns captured, 3,000 soldiers captured. It could have been the absolute end had not Sheridan held his ground with his men, been up early, and allowed them to be prepared for that to happen. And one other thing, that General Breckinridge, who had one of his soldiers executed for desertion, he refused to send reinforcements to Bragg across the river, as Bragg had ordered. Now, to be fair, he thought an attack was coming on his side and hadn't got the news that that attack had been withdrawn because Rosecrans's Union Army was in tatters and they had to throw reinforcements to the main battle. But Breckinridge refused to come across, and that was that. There was nothing else to be gained. Sheridan's people, Sheridan's men, a lot of them died, but they were able to hold their position. So end scene one. That's the morning of December 31st, day one of the battle. So maybe I'll stop there so that this isn't just a big long-winded me getting excited about something and talking on and on. Any thoughts you have there, Mike?
Hopefully, if you're able to view the picture of the rock formation, I've never seen anything like that.
I know.
It almost looks like, yeah, it was carved for the purpose of warfare. Reminds you of a World War One entrenchment or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's a natural formation that just lent itself to providing some cover, but obviously wasn't completely everything that they needed.
Yeah, and it was sort of pinned in by very thick forests at the time. So, you know, you couldn't run either. You could sort of hide, but you couldn't run. And so these men made their stand there, sort of closed in on three sides with the Confederates running at them. And that was the point at the beginning of the battle that, you know, if it had collapsed, that would have been the end of the whole thing. They were able to hold here at great cost. And again, only because they were up earlier than everybody else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And as somebody who's not a morning person.
Oh,
yeah. I appreciate the heck out of, you know, hey, yeah, guys, it's 4 a.m. It's cold and rainy.
Yep.
Let's get dressed and go outside.
Yep.
See if anything exactly bad happens.
Well, and a lot of them didn't even have tents, by the way. They were just blankets on the ground at the time. So, I mean, this was just brutal. One of the Confederate regiments, had handed out whiskey rations for breakfast that morning, and which was a great idea for a number of reasons. One being they were all freezing, you know. So it was a brutal, brutal day, and became a bloody, bloody day. So let me give you scene two. 11 a.m. They regroup. So this is a shot walking down sort of one of the picketed areas there. The Union troops regrouped and held the Nashville Pike. Some reinforcements came up, some artillery came up, and wave after wave after wave were repelled by Colonel William B. Hazen's brigade. Again, I think about 800 men at a 4-acre wooded area called Round Forest. So this is what Round Forest looks like today. And you can see there is a monument there. We'll get to the monument, but let me explain. Hazen was originally in the regular army. He had been in the war with Mexico, and he, like many of the regular army, kind of had a disdain for the volunteer soldiers. And now he's in charge of volunteer soldiers. This is a volunteer brigade that he's in charge of. A lot of folks from Ohio. I know many of our listeners are in Ohio. You can be proud on this one. The volunteers under his command, he basically said, we are not going to be embarrassed. We are going to drill and drill and drill and be good, disciplined soldiers. And it's a really good thing he did that, because his brigade was the only part of the line to hold that day. You know, even Sheridan's men eventually had to retreat. They ran out of ammo. But Hazen's brigade basically held the position. They were the only Union unit not to retreat that entire day. And so this, it literally folded up. The park ranger said it really folded up around Hazen's positions like a jackknife coming back together. And that was kind of good, because now the right and left flanks could communicate really well with each other, and it was a nice big solid line. But wave after wave after wave of Confederate troops tried to take this position. They took so many casualties. It became known, instead of known as Round Forest, it became known as Hell's Half Acre. Hell's Half Acre, because so many troops died. Let's see, I don't want to spoil it too much here, but you see that there's a memorial to the soldiers here. We'll get to that here in a second. So Braxton Bragg, General Bragg, ends the day one of the battle, assuming they were about to win. There had been so many casualties. The Union had been on the back foot all day long. He, in fact, sent a telegram before he went to bed to Richmond, to the Confederate capital, saying, "The enemy has yielded his strong position and is falling back. We occupy whole field and shall follow him." And then he also says, "God has granted us a happy new year." And Bragg is shocked when he wakes up New Year's Day, 1863, to find that the Union is still on the field that morning. What had happened is that Rosecrans, the Union general, had done some work that night. He had maybe like a couple months before the battle, he had sent out an order to the army under his command saying, "I want a couple men from each regiment who can be detached and turned into engineers." He called them pioneers, a pioneer or engineer corps. And that it was sort of vague, and it wasn't clear, like, would they be their own unit? Sometimes they would be. Would they ever be returned to their unit? And so it was kind of controversial. Bottom line is, if he hadn't done that, first off, those folks and a little artillery battery funded by the Chicago Board of Trade, that was the sponsors, it was the Chicago Board of Trade battery, the main swell of the worst of the fighting from the Confederates on December 31st, that first day, they would have won if it had not been for that Chicago Board of Trade battery and these Pioneer Corps. And that night, Rosecrans had the Pioneer Corps work really hard on some engineering, ditches, earthworks, What I believe are called chevaux de frise, those big, sort of like a log with sticks pointing out of them, on all sides that can, you know, keep a horse from charging over it. They had just set up all sorts of, you know, defensive works, and were ready on January 1st. Now, the rest of January 1st, they both kind of agreed, let's lick our wounds, bury our dead, dress, you know, our wounded. And so nobody really fought January 1st, but January 2nd, fast forward to the end here, it is the end. On day three, Bragg again orders Breckinridge to attack the Union troops on a hillside near the river. Breckinridge protests, you know, that's suicidal, we shouldn't do it. He eventually does it. Turns out it's suicidal. He pushes back the North and they come over a hill to attack these retreating Union soldiers to face basically all of the cannon. It's all there. And they all fired at the same time. In less than an hour, there were 1,800 casualties. I mean, so the cannon, when that part of the battle was over and it was time to advance, they couldn't advance because there were so many bodies. They had to move the bodies to be able to roll the cannon through. It was that deep with bodies, and Breckinridge. It was mainly that orphan brigade from Kentucky, called the orphan brigade because they couldn't go back to Kentucky. You know, Kentucky wasn't a southern state, so they were volunteers in the South and had nowhere to go. They were orphans, so the orphan brigade is decimated. A third of them killed, not just casualties, just killed. And Breckinridge wanders the battlefield just crying out, oh, my poor orphans, oh, my poor orphans. So that's scene the second. I've got one more scene, but we can talk about that for a minute. Just a bunch of people making some decisions, some that happened way before the battle.
Well, and yeah, some that happened, you know, there was the wonderful foresight.
Yeah,
which is very cool. But then there's this this thing where the people in charge don't have enough information to make good decisions.
100%
in the moment, right? The intel on where is the enemy? What have they been doing during that day off? You know, so yeah, they're making decisions based on assumptions.
Yeah,
oh, I've got the enemy on their back foot. They're probably run away. Here's what we're gonna do. You know, none of it based on fact, all of it based on, you know, here's my assumptions of what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And in this case, I guessed wrong, right? The South chose poorly.
Yeah. And this general, or excuse me, General Hazen, is he a general? I've already forgotten. Colonel Hazen, who's got the volunteers that he's made drill and drill and be disciplined. You know, he didn't come in with an assumption of, do I have good data? Do I not have good data? He came in with an ethos. You know, he came in with the belief that we are not going to embarrass ourselves. That's what's important today, is that we're going to own the moment that we're in and do the best with what we have, whatever that is. And so he's told to hold this point. He's given some reinforcements. Boys, we're going to hold this point. Which leads us into Act Three, which happens a few months after the battle. Interesting that it's just a few months. So I'm showing a picture of this monument. The monument was put up by the soldiers. They were the ones who organized this. In 1863, in the months after the battle, before the war has been decided, and they were so touched by the sacrifice of their fellow soldiers that they were the ones who organized this. So you can't really read it. I got a close-up of the plaque that repeats what it says. It says, Hazen's Brigade, to the memory of its soldiers who fell at Stone River, December 31st, 1862, quote, their faces toward heaven, their feet to the foe, inscribed at the close of the war. The monument's put up before the close of the war. The inscription happens afterwards. And just so you can sort of appreciate it, there's, I can't remember how many soldiers are buried inside, but the ones that fell right there are there. It's the oldest let me see if I can get this right. It's the oldest still standing monument that has been put up on a Civil War battlefield. We don't have anything older. The oldest Civil War monument still standing in its original battlefield location. Now for the postscript. It's a beautiful area. This is where the slaughter happened. This is where the 1800 Orphans Brigade fell. But now back to that Hazen's monument, Hazen's Brigade's monument. Here's a monument outside of it. Notice the date, 1834 to 1909. It's just a little military grave marker outside of the monument and the stone fence around the monument. And it says, this guy dies in 1909. Name, William Holland, Sergeant, Colored 1st Regiment, I believe is what it is. This is a Kentucky slave. A Kentucky slave who joined the Union Army, was captured and re-enslaved and used as a servant, escaped and fought again and was promoted to sergeant. He was part of the team who eventually helped bury the dead, deal with the battlefield, and I believe even build this monument that he's buried next to. The reason he's buried here is because this colored soldier bought the property. Mm-hmm. So in the Civil War, we have a former slave fighting for the North who eventually settles in this area and has a farm owning land, a slave owning land on the very land where people fought and died for his right to be able to do that. The community, it was a black community, freedmen, called Cemetery, appropriately enough. Many of the people were former soldiers or former people working on the grave site who settled there. And so he's buried there. And just in case you think that there wasn't a little bit of pride, he could have been buried in the military cemetery nearby where most of the soldiers are buried. He's buried here in the property he owned, where the men made the sacrifice for his right to do so. And oh, by the way, his son, a World War I veteran, also buried next to him, William Harlan. So I get super excited when you get these moments where the sacrifice is so clear and they know what it was worth and they know the value of the sacrifice they made. But there's your third act and postscript of the story as I see it. So many men making so many choices.
Oh yeah. 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 This, you know, from each one of them, each soldier's individual choice to join
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
You know, and then it all comes together and then their leaders make choices. And then, you know, it just continues to unfold. And it's, you know, had anybody made one different choice, the outcomes, you know, it's the kind of the butterfly effect, right? Right.
Right.
How would that have rippled across our country, right? Would that have ultimately changed the outcome of that war and the future of the United States? You know, it's pretty wild.
The what if scenarios really spin out of control the more you think of it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of the Japanese movie concept of Rashomon. And Rashomon, you've seen it in a lot of different movies where they show the character and he's running, they jump on the subway and he gets on the subway, meets some girl and something. And then they show, all right, what happens if he misses that subway? Right. And he turns around, walks away, doesn't meet that person, but he meets somebody else or he gets hit by a car or, you know, so right. the Rashomon effect is, all right, so what happens at any point in your life where something does or doesn't happen, and what is the impact of that for the entire future, right?
Right, right. And I think here it's sort of a what I think is so interesting about the Civil War is that they had to have known things were so heightened at that time. You know, values were being so clarified by the things that they were willing to struggle for, that they had to have appreciated how incredibly serious each moment was. And what strikes me is that things are always important. You know, the choice I have to get up early in the morning every day, like I'm choosing to make that choice or not. And little decisions every day are how I'm going to, you know, it's not get my work done. It's like do the things that I feel like I'm called on earth to do. But it's just getting up in the morning. It's just that little decision. Mm-hmm. And yet so much cosmic importance is behind it. You know, you want to react sarcastically to that employee who did, you know, something stupid or has been disrespectful or whatever. And, you know, the right thing to do is hold your tongue and have the crucial conversation the right way. Mm-hmm. And so much hinges on that little moment, right? You're setting a tone. You're establishing what's culture for your workplace. You and that employee are maybe experiencing the beginning of a rift that cannot be healed if you go much further. But it's just a little sarcastic comment. And yet so much cosmic importance is hinging on that moment. I'd like to think that we could go through all of our life, you know, feeling like, hey, we're in war. It's wartime. Things are that important. Things are that significant. Make good choices. But we tend not to do it because, yeah, it's just work. It's just my family. It's just an everyday day. You know, I'm not in battle, but you kind of are. You kind of are. So that to me is the inspiring part of this.
You make some fantastic points. And sometimes it's the short-term gratification versus the long-term reward. And that's the choice we're making. Your example of, yeah, it'd be a lot of fun to yell at this employee who's being disrespectful and, you know, set him straight, have a, you know, come to Jesus meeting or, you know, but yeah, that may be rewarding in the short term, but will it solve the problem in the long term? Will it
right.
create additional problems beyond that?
Right.
And so being able to make a choice and say, yeah, here's what may feel good now, that ice cream cone, that pile of chocolate chip cookies. But the long run, right, I want to live long enough to see my daughter get married. You know, I've got to make those choices now that will ultimately determine or better determine what happens in the future.
Yeah, I love that. And for me, you know, it's, you know, short term versus long term versus, you know, really we could talk about eternal term. You know, I know that not everybody's going to share my faith, but the idea that I'm going to answer to God at some point, or you know, what's really going to be the thing that lasts in my life? It's the relationships, right? It's not the things. It's not the fleeting glory that I get by being, you know, a well-known YouTube influencer, for instance. Just to circle all the way back around.
Yes. Yeah, so, I think that. Fleeting is the key word there.
Totally. Yes. Totally.
Yes.
For our audience.
So having values, having a purpose, having a path forward, incredibly important. And those things will make the decisions that you make easier to make. Right. Does this decision align with who I want to be, who I choose to be? Or does this distract or take me away from that?
So let me end with a couple more pictures and one final thought. The one final thought is we love helping people do this. You and I love helping people get clarity on their purpose, on their values, on what they want to be about, and then putting together a plan to achieve that. So if we can help you, please reach out. Of course, don't forget to hit that smash, like, subscribe, whatever it is I'm supposed to say at this point. But yeah, we'd love to have you share our podcast if we can help you. And here's a couple pictures just to bring us home, to take us to a lighter hearted moment.
Oh,
there's my family. My younger of two sons purchased a raccoon in the store at the national battlefield park.
For our PETA fans, that is a stuffed raccoon.
Yes, yeah. not a real one. Yes. It's a stuffed one, and it is identical to one that he thought he lost, that he had named because of some stuff he was going over in school at the time, Gandhi. I asked him, you know, what are you going to name this one? And he said, yeah. Is there any other famous Gandhis? And I shared that there was a female Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, who became famous as well. And by the end of the day, he had forgotten her name and had renamed this. His original raccoon, which we found, was named Gandhi. And this raccoon he has named Sean Gandhi. That's right. The ever popular Hindi name, Sean Gandhi. So there's that. And one more. Guess what's also in Murfreesboro, Mike Marshall?
Ooh.
It's the JCs.
The JCs.
I got a log cabin.
Yes. And it's a nice log cabin.
It's a nice log cabin. Yeah. I took that picture just for you, knowing that you were president of the JCs once upon a time.
Oh yes, in a life long gone. But it's interesting. In a lot of small towns in America, you'll still find parks,
yep,
buildings, airports that were originally. JCs were part of the early postal service. Airmail was a project that they were instrumental in. So. Yeah, they've left there again. They've left their fingerprints in a positive manner all across this country, and it's an international organization as well across the globe. So yeah, that's exciting.
Some people made some decisions, right?
Yeah, they decided to band together as volunteers and to make positive things happen.
Love it.
Very cool. Right.
I'm done.
All right, if you're out there listening, go make some good decisions. Let's get something done today. And we do appreciate you. And we also appreciate our announcer, the man, the myth, the legend, the voice, Mr. Wolf.
And that's a wrap. It Doesn't Take a Genius, the blog dedicated to reducing the irreducible. Next time, prime numbers. What makes them so special? Join us then. And thanks for listening.
That's good enough.